Robert Half research indicates 9 out of 10 hiring managers are having difficulty hiring. If you have open roles, chances are you're feeling this too. That's why you need Robert Half. Our specialized recruiting professionals engage with our proprietary AI to connect businesses of all sizes with highly skilled talent in finance and accounting, technology, marketing and creative, legal, and administrative and customer support. At Robert Half, we know talent. Visit roberthalf.com today.
And welcome back to the First Cup Podcast with Kyle Porter. That's Kyle Porter. I'm Chip Patterson. And Kyle, we are continuing our coverage, counting down to the Masters. The Dell Technologies match play is underway this morning, and I'm sure that when I'm back from the East Regional in Washington, D.C., we'll have plenty to recap from, let's see, whoever got eviscerated in group play and has to pick up all their respect from all across Austin Country Club. But how are you doing at this time? Is all of your Masters content close to turned in at this point?
It's getting there. I'm about to wrap up. It's kind of weird because you don't want to write it too far in advance.
Right.
Because there's still things that can happen, like Rory winning every hole at match play this week or something.
Possible.
But you also want to, it's, I don't know. It's kind of tricky. It's a very first world problem, but it's difficult to determine when to turn in my Masters content so I can actually travel to the Masters.
Well, the history stuff is one of the reasons why people love Augusta National, why they love the Masters. So we thought it would be fun to take a trip down some of the most unique facts from the tournament and the championship in itself, its history, and how different golfers have performed at the course, and the tidbits from within the libraries. And Kyle, you've done the legwork here, so I'm gonna let you take the lead on this 10 facts, and let's dig into it.
Yeah, so I've got I think I've got 20 or 25 right now. I was kind of putting together what I thought was going to be like 18 facts about the Masters, and this is a very it's sort of a random list. It's essentially all the cutting room floor stuff that that I was researching in kind of prepping for this year's Masters. So it's just not cutting room floor, but just like these leftovers that kind of stood out. So I've tweeted a few of these out. I've pulled from books. I've pulled from masters.com. I've submerged myself in Wikipedia. I've picked up stuff from the Masters media guide. It's kind of all over the place, but there's definitely some interesting things that stand out. So I'm going to give you 10 just kind of at random. And we're going to start with a play. So this is something that I tweeted out, and I thought it was super interesting just because of kind of recent history. A player has won their first Masters in every number of try from 1 to 15. So there's been a golfer that's won on their first try. There's been golfers that have won on their second, third, fourth, all the way to 15. Nobody's won in their 16th, 17th, or 18th try, but Sergio won in his 19th try.
Right.
Which to me is super interesting. And the most common winning attempts, I guess, in winning your first Masters was, I think, third and fourth. They both had 8 winners. So that's kind of like the most, you know.
That's statistically a sweet spot where if you get there, and let's, you know, unpacking it, you get there, you get a look at the course, you get a feel for the rhythm of the week, for what it's going to be like out there. And then if you were playing at the Masters, we assume you were one of the world's best golfers. And after a couple of tries, you're able to capitalize on it. And maybe what goes into that is being a little bit too, not young, but a little bit at least Masters inexperienced, so that you're not feeling the weight of having been there without winning, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, yeah, it's definitely, I think that third and fourth is a sweet spot. There's only been 8 golfers that have won their first Masters in their 11th try or more. So 11, 12, 13, and so on. And this is... this is Rory's 11th Masters, which is interesting. And I think we talked about this a couple episodes ago, but it's, you know, like you have to have been really good at a young age to play in 11 Masters by the time you're 29.
Which also explains Sergio, right?
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
If you are and, you know, like if did Jordan win in his first or his second Masters?
He won, I believe, he didn't win first because the last first-time winner was Fuzzy Zeller in 1979. I think Spieth was second. I think his first one was, might have been third.
But my point being that if Spieth doesn't win and he's, you know, still there playing, the fact that he had been invited and played in all those Masters probably puts him on a little bit of a different, more of a Sergio Rory track than a player who plays his first Masters at 27.
For sure. Yeah. No, Spieth, I believe his first was in 14 when he finished right behind Bubba, and then he won it in his second try in 2015.
Do you know what try it was when Phil Mickelson broke through?
Do you have it pulled up?
I don't.
I think Phil and Adam Scott were both on their 12th try.
Mm. And this is Rory's 11th?
This is Rory's 11th.
Not going to be the year. Go ahead and sign me up for 2020.
Did you see some of his quotes? Not to deviate too much, but some of his quotes from Match Play.
Rory?
Yeah, it's pretty interesting.
Uh-oh. I don't like the tone of your voice. I haven't seen the quotes.
No, hit me with them.
Okay.
I loved it. I got a couple of them highlighted here. He said, I would have said a couple of years ago, I need to win a Masters. I need a green jacket. Whereas now it's, I want to win it. I would love to win it. But if I don't, I'm okay. And I think that's the difference.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that's super interesting. you know, like, I'm, all right. Like there's a difference between me enjoying Rory's emotional depth and me just being like, all right, cool, you're mature, whatever.
So he says, so knowing 9 times out of 10, you're going to fail, you know that's pretty freeing. That's freedom. So I'm going to try my ass off here. I think he's talking about Match Play. And I'm probably not going to win. But as long as you can take the positives from it and move on to the next tournament and the next tournament and the next tournament and keep going. And then he says some more stuff about Augusta. He also said, the other thing he said, it's not being defined by your wins and losses. It's sort of what we talked about after the players. That's the secret of being freed up. It's not buying into narratives and living and dying with every tournament or every shot. I think that's very important.
I think that kind of stability probably is great in an individual sport. I think it would fail terribly in a team sport.
How so?
I think that you really do have to have the losing is not acceptable, it's not what I was made to do mentality with a team sport.
Yeah, but I think, I mean, there's a difference like when you're the you know, whoever, Charlotte Hornets, and you're like, we need to win like 60% of our games to get to the playoffs, versus when you're Rory and you lose so much. I mean, you lose 90% of the time.
Right.
If you lose 90% of the time, you're one of the best ever. That's kind of the clip that he's lost at. So I think it's very different, and which is what you're saying.
Right. Yeah. Just totally. It's just so funny because the speaking to like the college basketball coaches, the most successful ones, like the idea of losing never enters the mindset or at least the messaging to the team. You know, they're just like,
yeah.
No, you were made for this moment and you're going to go win this game. This is how this is going to happen. Now go do it. And that's
who do you have in DC, by the way?
Mike Krzyzewski, Tom Izzo, the ghost of Will Wade, and Buzz Williams.
Ghost of Will. I wanted Buzz Williams in Stillwater. I think he's awesome.
He is awesome.
Okay, number two. We've got which way should we go here? Okay. So Jack Nicklaus, unsurprisingly, holds the record for most cuts made at 37. That's not really the crazy part. The crazy part is that this number, 37 cuts made, is 7 more than the second most, which is Gary Player at 30.
So how many cuts missed does he have?
He doesn't have that many because he stopped playing at a pretty young age. And he like didn't miss a cut when he was like, I've got his 1960s and 1970s pulled up. He missed one cut and he won five times and had 16 top tens in those two decades.
Goodness gracious. See, that's one of those, that's one of those for Jack Nicklaus too, where the dominance across the 60s and 70s at the major championships is the crux of the argument for the GOAT debate, right?
Yes. His 1970s Wikipedia page is the GOAT debate.
The fact that it's all top tens and wins.
Yeah, he has. So his 1970s at the majors, he played in all of them. So that's 40. He had eight wins and five finishes outside the top 10.
Outside. That means all of the rest of them were inside the top 10.
Yeah, one miscut.
Yeah.
Stupid. I mean, that's the whole debate. He missed, so he played until 2005. He missed 3, 4, 5. He missed six cuts ever at the Masters. No, seven. He missed one as an amateur.
I also
So 44 tournaments, 37 made cuts, 7 missed cuts.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, is like the other side of that for just trying to put in perspective what 37 made cuts at the Masters looks like, is that you were playing on the weekend for almost 4 decades. That's insane in a professional sports career.
It's crazy. And one of the best parts is, so 98, this is one of my favorite things ever, 98. And I went back and read the Rick Riley story on it because it's ludicrous. He's 58 years old and Tiger had just, I mean, obviously just burned it down in 97, won by 12 over Tom Kite. I think this is in my facts. We'll make this number 3. 98, Jack Nicklaus beats Tiger Woods at the 98 Masters. He's 58. He finished T6, and he went out that Sunday, and I think he played the front in like 31 or something. And people were, I mean, if you should go back and read the Rick Riley thing, because it's awesome. And I think he played the back in like 35 or 36. Like, he just didn't make a putt on the back. But he finished T6 to Mark O'Meara, and I think he lost by three or four. It's 58. I mean, it's one thing to do it at an open where you can kind of, you know, meander around, but at Augusta, the year after Tiger did what he did, it's crazy.
The two things about that. Number one, I do love from that piece, Tiger admitting that he was having to back off of balls because of roars that he was hearing elsewhere. And then the other thing, and I hope I'm not ripping from another one of your Masters facts, but I had forgotten that when Tiger burned it all down in 1997, it was after he shot a 40 on the front nine on Thursday.
Yeah.
Like that's got to be in Masters history, like, one, obviously Tiger's 97 is like a huge Masters history moment, but even within that win, I didn't have the recognition of the details of the tournament at the time, and I'm really only realizing now that, so that is basically from like a front nine to like turn it around the rest of the way, that's got to be one of the most insane 180s, to go from the 40 on the front nine on Thursday and then just go and blitz it the rest of the way.
Yeah, he went 40-30 on the first day to shoot 70, which is just, it's awesome,
right?
And he didn't and this will be number 4. So this is another one I have in there. He didn't make a bogey. Tiger didn't make a bogey on the back nine, on the second nine in 97.
None.
36 holes, no bogeys. He had he played him in 16 under, so he had 12 birdies, 2 eagles, and 22 pars.
It's the most cliche. I mean, it's not the most cliche because it's the final 9 holes, but I mean, the first 9 is slept on for sure, but man, there's just so many scoring opportunities and so many fun holes on the back nine that that's like that's that is what memories of iconic Masters moments look like for the most part.
Yeah, and I think, you know, and we do that with every event, right? Like, who, does anybody, and it's hard because you notice this, I think, more when you're writing about it and talking about it. Like, all anybody talks about is the last three holes of a tournament.
Right.
And when you get to the Masters, it extends to like six or nine or whatever. But nobody talks about the front nine except at Augusta. But even there, it's not really talked about that much just because there's not, I don't know, just because that's not where the tournament is quote unquote won on a Sunday, even though it is. It could be won there on a Friday. You know,
right?
But it's just the nature of like the way it's set up. I think this isn't one of my facts, but the nines used to be the other way at Augusta. Imagine that. What if you were playing? What if you had it the other way? Imagine how much more interesting two would be. How much more interesting the eighth hole would be, the par five uphill.
That'd be crazy. Yeah, but think about how awful that start is.
What do you mean? Like just difficult?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hi, yeah. Welcome to Augusta National. Here's a punch in the face.
Nicholas went out in 33 in 98. He shot 35 on the back on the second nine.
Mm. Hey, listeners, the madness is here and we're a step closer to one shining moment and the best place to stay on top of all NCAA tournament coverage. That's CBS Sports HQ. What is CBS Sports HQ? I mean, you know it. We're on it all the time. It's the free 24-hour streaming sports network that's built for fans like you and me and Kyle and everybody else. You'll find all the latest tournament coverage, including updates from me at Washington, D.C., Matt Norlander at Louisville, and more from around the country. Tons of highlights, analysis, and stats. It's everything you need to know about what happened in the game without any of the yelling, without any of the fake debates, or any of the politics that you'll find on other sports networks. If you like listening to me on this podcast, you'll love catching me or Kyle on CBS Sports HQ. Tune in from now until the nets are cut down in Minneapolis for winning picks and bets from our college basketball experts. CBS Sports HQ, it's always on and it's always free. Download the CBS Sports app on your phone, Fire TV, Roku, or Apple TV to watch today.
Okay, I've got some scoring numbers here. We're on number five, I think.
Yes.
Okay, so do you know what the highest score to ever win a Masters is?
One over.
Yeah, I think you looked at this document, didn't you?
I did.
So it's only happened three times in which a score over par has won the Masters. It happened in 1954, Sam Snead, 1956, Jack Burke Jr., and then Zach Johnson did it in my first Masters to attend in 2007. That was not the best introduction to the Masters. Zach Johnson winning at 289.
Right.
I went with my dad, and it was still like one of the best memories ever, but it was cold, and it was Zach Johnson laying up on par fives to win a green jacket. Not ideal. But, you know, I think that it sort of speaks to like I'm kind of become obsessed with like, what's the statistical profile of like how you win the Masters. And traditionally it's certainly not by laying up on par fives. You know, it is and, distance
and relying on those nasty chip shots.
Yeah, it's length. It's not wedge play. It's short and long iron play. And so I think you have to look at that Zach Johnson win and say, is that how a Kevin Kisner wins the Masters? Is that how a Jim Furyk's a bad example just because he's kind of past where we would consider him a real candidate, but somebody like him who's a short hitter, is that how they win them? Is that the only way somebody like that wins the Masters is you get bad weather and it's cold and it kind of knocks these other guys out of it. It's kind of, I don't know. It's kind of interesting.
I was trying to, when I mean, I looked at the doc, we've been talking about this show for a while. So I wanted to brush up on the information and I was trying to play out in my head what any any higher winning score would look like. And it's just, there are so many opportunities and the golfers are so good that it has to take horrendous playing conditions to imagine there being any kind of over par winner here. Or even I don't even know if one under or two under seems like a reasonable final score to expect from the Masters in 2019. I just, those two combinations, the players are too good and there's too many scoring opportunities.
Well, it really is interesting because even the course, and this is tied to its roots in Scotland and also tied to the fact that it's a great course, is that if you get bad weather, I mean, I was there in 16, we get Rory Spieth final pairing on Saturday and it's cold, it's windy, it's kind of nasty. And you see Rory go 77 and it felt like Spieth won the tournament with like a 73, And so you start to, but this, the winning number, Danny Willett on Sunday was still 5 under. And so it's, you almost have to get 4 straight days of that to get a winning number over par. But you do see guys really struggle at this course because of the precision necessary from distance whenever the weather's kind of bad, whenever it's blowing a little bit. And I love that. I think that's great. I think that's, you talk to people that are like steeped in course architecture and they talk about how that's the sign of a great course. That's what we see at St. Andrews. That's what we see at, a lot of places in Scotland like that.
All right, what's our next? Actually, we'll continue to keep this fact train rolling right after this.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is here to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 15% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
All right, what's next?
So I got another Jack Nicklaus one for you. It's number 6. Jack Nicklaus holds the record for wins, 6. Top 5s, he's got 15. Top 10s, he's got 22. And top 15s, he's got 29. Here are the runners-up in those categories. So wins, it's Arnold Palmer and Tiger Woods.
Average top, golfers.
Top 5s, it's Phil and Tiger. Top 10s, it's Ben Hogan and Sam Snead. Top 10s, it's Ben Hogan, and top 15s, it's Sam Snead. So he basically has taken 5 of the best golfers ever and beat them in every way you can at Augusta National. And so the point for me is, like, he might not be the best ever, but he's the best ever at Augusta.
That's a good way to address the argument.
Yeah. And part of it's longevity, right? Like, Tiger's missed a lot of Masters.
Yeah, he doesn't have 37 made cuts.
No, and he won't. I don't think. I don't think he'll get there. I don't think that'll happen.
All right, what's next?
I've got a lot of Jack Nicklaus on here. You've already seen all this. Pretend like you haven't seen it. This is number 7. Which hole do you think has had just one ace in its history?
Oh, I don't know this.
So there's 4 par threes. You got number 4, you got number 6, you got 12, and you've got 16.
I think 12 and I feel like I've seen aces at 12 and 16. You said 4 and 6, so the other two?
Yep. Yep.
I'm going to go 6.
It's actually number 4.
Okay.
So 4 is the huge bunker in the front, and it plays forever, but the only ace ever was Jeff Sluman in 1992. He had a 4-iron from 213 yards.
Jeez.
And ended up finishing T4 that year to Freddie Couples.
So you've got is that just a hole that even is tough to birdie, or is it just like only very rare for the hole in one?
It depends on the pin. I don't think it plays as the toughest hole on the course. I think the toughest hole on the course is usually 11. But if they've got, I'm trying to think of the pin position. I think back right is there's like an upper shelf. It's really difficult to get it back up in there,
especially when it's already a longer par 3.
Yeah, it's really long, and it's kind of it's tough. It's a tough green to hit. It's not a tough green to hit. It's a tough green to be in the right position on.
Gotcha. All right. What you got?
What are we on? 7? 8?
Yeah, 7.
What do you think is the most common cut number since the 1950s at Augusta? So this is a Masters.com special. They've been keeping track of this since, I think, 1957. So cut number, even par, would obviously be 144. What do you think has been the most common cut number since 1957?
146.
146 is actually on the low end. 148 has been the most common. Kind of surprised me. 4 over has been the most common cut number.
Did I just do that number right? I was looking for 2 over, right?
Yeah, two over is 146. Yeah.
Okay. I guess that's surprising. I thought that it would be. I always imagine, especially after Friday, that there is such a large collection of players that are between 2 under and 2 over that sometimes the grouping there can keep the cut line much. Obviously, my expectations were that the cut line would be closer to even par at that 2 over than to be further down, I suppose. I mean, does the field get cut in clean half?
It used to be, I think, top 44. Now it's top 50 now.
Plus ties.
I think we've done this thing with Augusta. So if you look at, I would imagine, I have no idea what the number is, but I would imagine a regular PGA Tour event that 146, what you said, 2 over is a very, or even better, like 145 or 144 is very common. And I think we've done this thing at Augusta where we're like, oh, guys can just dominate Augusta now. Like, they can just blast it 320 yards and they can overpower the course. But it's still, and Patrick Reed talked about this on his teleconference last week, it's still a very, like, you have to be so precise into so many of these holes. And if you're not, you can make doubles, you can make triples. And that's what makes it, it's both easy and really hard.
That makes sense.
At the same time, which I think is awesome for a course and for a tournament. And Andy Johnson of the Fried Egg talks about this all the time. It's a great separator of who is playing the best golf. Because if you're super if you're even not precise for like 2 or 3 holes, then it could be over. I mean, Sergio said that. He's like, I didn't miss a shot. He goes, that's whenever he hit it in the water like 10 times on 15. He said, I didn't miss, that's the first 13 I've made without missing a shot, which is a very like
Sergio
thing to say. But it's also, you know, kind of true.
Oh, man. Yeah. All right. What else? I'm waiting for this boxing. Like, come on, let's talk about this.
Okay, well, we'll do. I'll double these up. So as recently as 1960, the cost to get into the Masters for the entire week was $12.50.
What is it in 2019?
It's $106
2019. For the week?
For the week.
Well, not to mention the difficulty of actually getting the badges. So that's one of those things where like face value is one thing, but then there is a amount of effort and energy and potentially money that you cannot put a price on in terms of obtaining them.
Yeah, I think this year's badges are like $375 for the week, which is still like a joke. I mean, in terms of best value you
right.
can have.
Right.
So another thing on badge prices in the mid 1940s, this is from Kurt Sampson's book called The Masters, which is really good and really interesting, and everybody should read it. In the mid 1940s, this was right after the war, after World War II. I think it was 1946 was their first tournament back. Clifford Roberts raised the ticket price from $3 to $5. And this is what Kurt Sampson wrote about Roberts in his book. Said, as a member of the tournament's improvement committee, Byron Nelson remembers the impassioned speech Cliff delivered when the subject of admission revenue came up. This is what Clifford Roberts said. We went to New York recently to watch Bo Jack fight. We had ringside seats just to watch just two men fight. And here you've got a field of the best golfers in the world, and the people are paying just $3 while we paid $50 for those ringside seats. That's ridiculous.
That's the most 1940s American sporting event conversation ever. As soon as I read that story, I was like, oh, man, just let me take a big, deep breath so I can blow the dust off this reel-to-reel canister of facts. Oh, that's so good. Like that's like the NBA looking at the NFL's TV contract in the 2010s and being like, what? Uh-uh. Nah, price is going up on the brick. Let's go.
Yeah, that was great. I love that book. It's a must read for everybody. Kurt Sampson's The Masters. It's called, hold on, let me grab it.
Yeah, I mean, he watched two men pummel each other. And then he probably fancies the game of golf a far more advanced sport. He was like, wait a second. This is like
so it's
heavyweight fights without actually having the concussions.
Yeah, and it lasts 4 days instead of 4 minutes.
Right.
The book is called The Masters, Golf, Money, and Power in Augusta, Georgia.
Mm.
It's fascinating. Okay, so what are we on? 8, 9?
Yeah.
9?
You said we're doubling up, so we are on 9.
Okay. The top 5 golfers currently in career scoring average at Augusta. So the minimum require, or the minimum here is 25 rounds. So you have to have played at least 25 rounds. So no surprise, Tiger number 1, 70.5. Phil Mickelson number 2, 71.2. Number 3 was surprising. Jason Day, 71.6. Then you got Rory at 71.8 and Justin Rose at 71.8.
All right, let's talk about Jason Day real quick.
Okay.
Is that indicative of just sort of like where the space that Jason Day occupies, maybe not only at the Masters, but just in the major championship conversation? That like there's a certain, I guess, is Jason Day health issues and WDs excluded and overlooked? Is Jason Day just a really, really, really high floor major championship golfer?
I don't know. I honestly think it's more indicative because these numbers are so tight. I think it's also indicative of just, I would imagine the overall scoring average has dropped at Augusta over the last, 20, 30, 50 years.
Oh, and like we've got all these players between 70.5 at Tiger and 71. I mean, that's one stroke, and all these players are ones who have won, or at least ones that have been competing in the last 20 years.
Well, and the other, yeah, and so the other part of that is you have to factor in, because guys play until they're like 70, you have to count those rounds.
So younger players are going to be more likely to have lower averages.
Yeah, and so it's almost like it's kind of a, it's a real stat, but I don't love it because it doesn't. I think even more crazy is that Jack Nicklaus is like just behind Rory, even though he played when he was, like I said, 58, 60, you know, whatever. He didn't play that long, but, and so maybe he's a bad example, but Jack Nicklaus's scoring average, even with kind of the tail end, is 71.9 and Rory is 71.8.
Mm.
Which is, I think, pretty incredible.
Yeah. That's like that's also a situation where, when we're ranking our, you almost want to maybe take those stats in groups, right? Where like a shooting percentage or efficiency numbers or strokes gain numbers, when the difference between like a number 10 and a number 17 is not actually like seven individual spots as much as it is 0.02 of a decimal point or something.
Right. Yeah, totally.
Pretty nice top tier though.
Yeah, it's pretty good. Yeah, there's so many. You can just get lost on Masters.com for so long. I'm trying to find, because they actually did break them into like age groups, or not age, but like by rounds played, career scoring average. Here we go. So 100 or more rounds, Jack Nicklaus is number one, 71.98. Fred Couples is number two, 72.02.
Always Fred Couples in the head to heads.
Yeah. Nicklaus has played 106, or I guess he won't add to this, but he played 163 rounds at Augusta. 41 full years.
Just 4 decades of playing winning golf at Augusta National.
And his career average is under par. It's crazy.
Insane.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
If you take it down to 75 to 99 rounds, it's Tiger at 70.5. It's Phil at 71.3, and then Hale Irwin at 70 at over par. So even Phil is like a stroke better than the next best.
Wow. What's your expectation for Phil at the Masters?
Who knows? I mean, I have no idea. He might try to swim the par 3 course. I don't know.
Have you been watching his Twitter tips?
It's kind of great. I feel like his Twitter account started off kind of like trying too hard, and now it's kind of doing everything in jest, like tongue in cheek, and it's pretty awesome.
I've loved it. I only got tuned into it about maybe in the last like 2 weeks or so, where he's like, "Well, I missed 2 cuts in a row, so we're doing a missed cut tip Tuesday." And he's always out there in his flip-flops, and you can see the like ATV style golf cart that's like pulled up right beside the green, and he's just out there showing you how to hit soft chip shots.
Yeah, it's awesome. Showing off his calves. It's great. By the way, it looks like Masters.com just updated all their numbers recently, so all my numbers are off. I mean, they're off by like a tenth of a decimal point. But,
oh, okay.
And it doesn't change the order, but if anybody's wondering, that's what happened.
I was going to say, I thought that you were going to say that the last 36 minutes of stats were all off.
No. By the way, Ricky Fowler has a better scoring average than Dustin Johnson at Augusta.
I believe it.
It's crazy. Okay, last one. Let's see here. What should we go with? This is like dumb, but I love it, and I want to see it this year. There's only been four instances in which a player has shot the exact same score every day.
That is dumb.
Walter Hagen did it in 1939. Lou Worsham did it in 1954. Kenny Knox in 1987. George Archer did it in 1989. Okay, we'll do something different instead.
No. Dustin Johnson's the most likely to do it. for sure.
He's like what, 468s?
No, 469s. Nice. I love this one. I like the fact that 70%, 57 of the first 82 Masters came down to a single stroke or went into a playoff, 70% and 15 percentage points higher than a normal PGA Tour event. Is that just chalked up to the pressure? And shout out to Johnny Miller. Goodness gracious, I can't believe I'm pulling out a Johnny Miller hat here. But like, can you attribute the fact that there are less runaway winners to the just atmosphere of Augusta National, the quality of the field? Like, is that really one of those, it's really, really hard to win a major, especially at Augusta type things, where the reason why it's always close is because of the intensity of playing through, especially like a Saturday and a Sunday?
I think so. I think that stat's even weirder because you have so many fewer players in the field than you do at a regular event. I mean, in a normal event, you have 100, like in the Opens, you have 156 players, right? At Augusta, we're going to have like 85 this year, 84 maybe. And so it makes that stat even crazier, right? I mean, I know that like your bottom 60 aren't usually contending anyway.
Right.
And that's mostly who you're excluding here, but it still is, I don't know. It still makes it pretty, pretty intriguing.
Like the way everything sets up on the course with the, like where the holes are, and it's just, and the way that you have to like win a Masters where a leader has to feel like they're playing defense, and you're hearing the roars all over the course. Like, I think that all of the things that make the Masters memorable as an experience to go and be there, or the reason why so many fans love to watch it every year, even if, like, for so many fans, the Masters is one of the only golf tournaments that they'll watch all year. And I think that there's something, either maybe it's the course or the, it's intangible perhaps, but the fact that it almost always is close coming down the stretch, I think that's really cool.
Yeah, I do too. And we've seen it. I mean, we saw it with Reed last year. We saw it with Sergio and Rose the year before that. Before that, we had Willett and Spieth as kind of runaways. There's nothing like it. You know, I tell people all the time, you know, Thursday, Friday is really, really fun to go to. And if it's your first time, like, maybe that's what you should do, because it's the best experience. But Sunday from like, I don't know, 2:30 to 6 is, it's almost like an out of body experience, an out of mind experience. Like, there's nothing I've experienced that feels and sounds and just heightens your senses like that 3.5 hour period does.
What happens at Augusta? Like, do you, on Sunday, are you trying to stay ahead, or are you just like running and trying to find like sight lines, like swinging from trees, trying to figure out a way to see something?
That's actually frowned upon usually at Augusta, but it's hard because, so last year we were in a group, I think it was me, Kevin Van Valkenburg and Brandon Porath, and it's like, okay, we're going to go all 18 with Rory and Reed. This is going to be a heavyweight fight, you know, all the stupid cliches. And then Spieth goes out in 31 and you're like, oh crap. Like, I got to go, like, should we go over there? Like, right. Is he going to shoot 60? Like, what's about to happen? And so you have to figure out like what you feel like the story is going to be. So we flipped over to Spieth, and, but then he doesn't birdie 17 and you're like, well, 62, 61's out of whatever the numbers were. And so you're like, well, should we go back with Rory and Reed? So you're kind of just, you're picking and choosing based on the leaderboards, and it gets tough because you don't, but especially
later,
when it gets,
yeah, like later in the afternoon, the whole course bottlenecks. Like, I mean, yeah, there are, once the leaders pass through a hole, that hole is not being played again. And therefore, like, patrons have no reason to stick around. So they're either leaving the property or they're just going to continue to fight the flood of fans.
Yeah, and they're not leaving the property. So.
Right. That's what I was thinking is like when you do have that, I guess when you've got like maybe in that like five, like 4:30 turns to 5 o'clock, and like the other holes are starting to just like, they're totally vacant. It's like everyone is just packed in to the final six or seven holes. How do you get ahead of it, or do you just pray that you can find a spot to wiggle in?
That's the hard part about Augusta, because you can't get between the ropes. Even as like all these other tournaments, media can just walk with the players or whatever. So I try to just wriggle in, and you kind of know the good spots. Like, you know where to go on 15, you know sort of where to go on 16. It's tough because there's so many people there. I actually would argue that like the last hour on TV is maybe the most fun or whatever. I would argue that it's like the 3 o'clock hour that's the most fun, because that's when everybody's on the last nine holes.
Right.
And like everything's kind of still in play. But then when the leaders get through 16, you're like, oh, well, there's only like two outcomes here, you know? So it's not as,
I mean, at that point you might as well start working your way back to the media center.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's sort of what I did last year with Reed. And I kind of saw the final putt. Like, I like glanced at it as I was walking to the media center. And it's impossible to see anything on 18. I think this year I'm going to try to be up more like by the clubhouse, just to see reaction from, you know, whoever, players, you know, Augusta National, whatever.
Yeah. Ricky Fowler before he comes out to give a handshake to the winner.
What if Ricky wins?
I'm happy. I'd be totally cool with it.
Okay, so this is a column I want to write. I don't know if I'm going to get to, but which star does a Masters win change their story the most? Like, who does it mean the most to?
Rory.
Yeah, that's right, isn't it?
Player of the moment, and if he wins it, completes the slam, he shoots off into another, like the, and it doesn't matter if his, you know, the talent level and the like. The other golfers that matter do still very much matter, but just where he's at right now, the like support that's been drumming up, if he wins it and puts on that green jacket, again, that doesn't mean that he is better than the other golfers that we like to talk about in that top group, but in terms of his star power and just sort of the way that it changes the narrative and the way he's talked about, it's a game changer.
I was reading an article today about, is this the best era ever for Euros? And it was a good article. It was interesting. But I was reminded that if he wins another major, it's only him, Faldo with six, and Seve with five that have five or more majors from the Europeans.
Yeah. I mean, I think he becomes, and probably also the great point there in terms of just the global draw of Rory McIlroy and his star power. Like Ricky's win would be an affirmation and have a greater celebration, certainly among the PGA Tour and the United States golf fans. The kids who've been dressing like Ricky for 8 or 9 years, and shoot, maybe even longer at this point, like that is something that would be fun and be a joyous occasion throughout the greater golf fans, at least as I've experienced them. But in terms of like really change, that's like Tony Bennett making Ricky Fowler winning the Masters is like Tony Bennett just even getting to the final four. It just sort of erases all the non-narratives. Rory winning the Masters, completing the slam, just sort of puts him on a like a rocket ship, shoots him off into somewhere else.
I think Rory, Ricky, and Tiger are probably your top three there. I think you know who else I think is up there. I think it's I think Koepka's up there, and then I think Bryson's up there.
I'll ride with you on Bryson. I totally agree on Koepka. I'm more skeptical about Bryson, but I think that part of that is also biased and shaded by a fact that I'm in a little bit of a fade Bryson position from my picks and my analysis for this tournament.
You know who I think it means the least, or would mean the least to, not personally, but just the way that we think about their legacy?
Patrick Reed?
No. Phil.
Yeah, I agree.
I don't think anybody knows how many green jackets Phil has.
It's two. Like, I think, or is it three? It's three.
Exactly. That's okay. My point. Like, yeah. You follow golf and like you don't and it's like they've all just kind of been melded together.
Right.
Like it, which is weird. Like it's very strange. Like everybody knows that, you know, Tiger has four and Jack has six and, you know, whatever. But we're like, how many times has Phil won this thing?
I don't think that winning would even though winning would take him off of that comparison we keep coming back to where it's like so-and-so has as many majors as Dustin Johnson. I don't know if Dustin Johnson winning the Masters greatly changes the conversation around Dustin Johnson.
Yeah, I do think the leap from I'm trying to think of who has like who's somebody who has two majors right now. I think the leap from two to three is a bigger deal than one to two. Because I mean, you look at like I don't know who has two right now. Who's somebody that I can't think of anybody. Justin Rose has one. Sergio's got one. Koepka going from three to four with a Masters and two U.S. Opens would be that'd be pretty crazy.
That would be crazy.
That would be wild.
If we could get Koepka against Rory head to head final pairing on Sunday, that would be and maybe the end result if it was an epic battle is that both of them end up just getting shot off into the rest of the major championship season with this like awesome back and forth. But I would say that Koepka might be also in that position of like, guys, are we sure that we're handling Koepka the right way?
By the way, I can't think of any golfer that has two majors.
All right.
DJ's got one, Rose has one, Koepka's got three, Rory's got four, JT's got one.
I mean, Francesca's. It's because the list of two is. I mean, Zach Johnson.
Yeah, there we go.
Zach Johnson, Martin Kaymer, Bubba Watson.
Well, Bubba's got... yeah, Bubba's only got two.
He's only got two. But then the rest of them are, I mean, you know, like Greg Norman, Ben Crenshaw, Curtis Strange.
Angel Cabrera.
Angel Cabrera. Yeah, I mean... I don't... If Bubba won... I don't know if it would change the way we talk about him.
No.
But I think that would be like an impressive jump, a 2 to 3 jump.
So 46 guys have won three, including Koepka and Spieth. 28 have won four, including Rory and Ernie Els. And that's pretty much it from contemporaries. 19 guys have won five, including Phil and Seve. Then it gets crazy. 13 guys have won six, including Faldo and Trevino. And only 11 guys have won seven or more.
In the list, of who is Harry Vardon?
Yeah, it was like the 1890s. So it's Jack, Tiger, Walter Hagen, Hogan, Player, Watson, Harry Vardon, Bobby Jones, Gene Sarazen, Sam Snead, and Arnold Palmer. You could make the case that outside of if you take Vardon out of it, that's your top 10 golfers of all time.
Yeah.
I wouldn't make that case, but I think you could make it.
Right.
And so you start talking about like, you know, I think that's more the significance for Phil and even Rory. I mean, yeah, the slam, of course, but also like historically, like can he get to the 7 club? Because the 7 club is I mean, it's only 11 guys ever since the 1890s. I mean, that's crazy.
Over under Rory McIlroy, major championships won, end of career, 6.5.
I mean, I think I go under.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, it's so hard to win him. And he's only got, what, 35 left, 40? I mean, is he gonna be like super competitive when he's 42?
No.
Maybe. I don't know.
No way.
I don't think so.
He's gonna have his own media network.
Our podcast is gonna be hosted on it.
That's fine. That's cool. Call me. Let's go. Roars. Come on.
Yeah, I'm ready. I'm fired up. I'm gonna add to my facts list and we'll be ready to go.
He is Kyle Porter. You can follow him on Twitter at Kyle Porter CBS. You can follow me at Chip_Patterson. Kyle, thank you very much.
Thanks, Chip.